real good superheterodyne design, the IF should be approximately 10% of the RF frequency. Well, 10% of 10 gigs would be roughly 1 gig. If you are following the rules, your tunable IF would be running at 1296 megacycles for a 10 gig transverter. As long as you've got the right kind of front end filters and the right kind of preamps, you can stretch the rules a little bit and go down to 144 megs. I would not go any further. Go down to 30 megacycles as a tunable IF. I don't recommend it. You're going to be, your image and your reel are going to be equal in magnitude, and that's not a desirable situation. Half your power is on the wrong frequency, and you're jamming other people, if you know what I mean. You could, if you want to, take the received 144 megacycles out of the transverter and put it into a second transverter in the shack that converts 144 megs down to 30 megs, if you wanted to. I know people who have cascaded converters. I do not recommend it, because in order to properly set up a transverter so you get reasonably good linearity on transmit and receive, with one transverter it's difficult enough. Cascading a pair of transverters and making everything work right, I don't recommend that. I won't say you can't do it, but try not to do that. Now, there's a couple of dangers you've got to worry about. Let me drop. And that is, you'll do reasonably well with 200 milliwatts, a barefoot transverter. I talked to guys in 10 states. However, I had some help. 100 feet of tower, 300 feet of land, on the center of Long Island, line of sight to both New England and down to the Philadelphia area. With that kind of a location, during contests in particular, operating across 10 states, getting a best DX of 384 miles, relatively easy under those conditions. But almost every 144 megacycle rig that you're going to use as the tunable IF, you've got to be darn careful to make sure that the rig is not going to give you a burst of power that damages the front end of the transmitter of the transverter. The transverter maybe wants 100 milliwatts of drive, and maybe it can tolerate 500 milliwatts maximum. And you're starting off with, let me pick a number, 100 watt or a 50 watt transmitter. You could just put a great big pad in there. But now that pad, you've got to remove it in the receive mode, otherwise it's hurting your noise figure, if you know what I mean. So the average guy finds some way of using the AGC circuit or whatever of his rig to try to cut it back to the 1 or 200 milliwatt region when it's in the transmit mode. You got to be careful. Some rigs, at the instant you press down the key, it'll give you a burst of a few watts of power, even though the AGC circuit is eventually going to settle down to the 100 milliwatt region. So unless you've got a real good limiting circuit in there of some kind, you've got to be awful careful about not overpowering your transverter with a spike of power each time you go into the transmit mode. You're also going to be using a transmit-receive relay at 10 gigahertz, which takes that same feed horn when you transmit into it, and you're going to receive from it. And somewhere in that vicinity, you're going to be putting a low-noise preamplifier. You've got to use good differential keying. You want to make sure that the relay has flipped into the transmit mode and has settled down and is not chattering anymore before the transmit...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You got to make sure the relay is settled down before the transmitter is turned on. It takes time, differential, keying to do that correctly, or an auxiliary set of contacts on the relay that confirms that it really is in the transmit mode before the transmitter is enabled. So there's a lot of guys that will wipe out their super low noise preamplifier by transmitting into the back end of it, because the instant they press the push to talk button on the transmitter, they're giving a command to the transmitter to start transmitting. They're giving a command to the relay to start flipping. The relay takes 20 milliseconds to flip, but the transmitter comes on the air in 1 millisecond. So for 9 milliseconds, you're putting full transmit power into the back of your low-noise preamp. And so terrible things can happen. So you got to be a little bit careful about timing. You got to be a little bit careful about the way you bring B-plus up to the box, the weatherproof box that's at the top of the tower behind the 2-foot dish, if you know what I mean. Make sure that the local lightning in the neighborhood doesn't give you an impulse on that wiring that creates damage in the electronics. Whether or not you shield it, whether or not you run the B-plus up the coax cable, there's various ways around that. So you guys know the technology, and I guarantee you'll enjoy 10 gigs, but you got to be a little bit careful. There's some extra dangers of running all your electronics remotely in a weatherproof box at the top of the tower. in the future weeks, as you and Barry set this up, I know you're going to have a lot more questions, but that's a thumbnail sketch that'll get you going. And once you start hearing signals at that higher frequency from that far away, guarantee you guys will be jumping up and down in the shack. And to EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Vic, K2RIW, TechNet, line lock in. So the
okay.
You mentioned 200 milliwatts. I guess the technology has moved on because I think the unit is like 1 watt or 2 watts. I got to take another look. I wonder if you looked at what Down East has to offer. They moved to Florida, by the way. But I guess there's a lot to know, you know, especially in packaging this. Is there anybody putting out a monthly or bi-monthly magazine that comes in the mail, preferably all over the internet, probably something in print so I can save, you know, dedicated to 10 gigs? I started getting QEX because I know there's some 10 gig stuff in there. Back to you, Nick.
Yeah. A decade ago, there was a monthly article in 73 Magazine by a guy in the San Diego area of California on the subject of 10 gigs. He's now a silent key, and no one has picked up that particular ball. The best I could recommend is the microwave reflector. WA1, all of a sudden, Dr. Tom Williams. I keep forgetting his call letters.
Yay.
Say again?
1MBA.
Beautiful. Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha. You Google that, WA1MBA.net or .org. You'll eventually find the so-called microwave reflector. And this is a group of guys, about 400 of them, scattered around the world, that are all doing serious microwave work, and 10 gigs is probably the most popular microwave band, with the exception of 1296. 10 gigs, and now they're doing an awful lot of work at 24 gigs. By way of that microwave reflector, you can ask any question you want, and within hours you'll be getting an answer. Because, as I said, it goes worldwide. You can ask a question at 4 o'clock in the morning, and somebody is awake at that time somewhere in the world and will give you an answer. So that's the best source of good, solid information. And yes, nowadays there are quite a few amplifiers on 10 gigs that will give you 1 watt, 3 watts, 5 watts, and 10 watts of output. Also, it's going to be very tempting to use an extremely big dish. Do not do that. The first dish you guys use on the tower, my strongest recommendation is you do not go above 2 foot diameter. It's very tempting to say, gee, if I go to 3 foot, I get all this extra gain. Yeah. A 2 foot diameter dish on that band is a 3 degree beam width. Plus or minus 1.5 degrees is 3 dB down. So aiming that with a good high accuracy rotator, let me drop. That in itself is a little bit of a science, because quite often you're going to be doing a calculation of knowing that you're talking to a guy in Mount Wachusett, and Mount Wachusett has this particular latitude and longitude, or it's got this particular grid square, and you plug it into a computer program, and you find out you aim at 37 degrees true in order to aim the dish in that direction in order to hear that guy. They set up these contacts on 144.260, single sideband. That's the so-called talkback frequency. You literally call your CQ on 144.260 during a 10-gig contest and say, is anybody within the sound of my voice on 2 meters ready to send me a signal on 10 gigs, and let's start talking. Yes, the more enthusiastic guys that go on top of Mount Equinox and Mount Washington will give a direct call CQ on 10 gigs itself. But for us other guys that are down in the flatlands, most of the calling takes place at 144.260. So do get yourself on the mailing list for Dr. Tom Williams, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, the microwave reflector, and you'll be getting a lot of information. Good luck with that project, Rich, and let us know how it goes. It's about time Barry get on 10 gigs. He's been talking about it for some time. It's about time I get back on it. I've been talking about doing that for some time. I've been talking about the good old days when I was there, and I had a lot of fun. Michael is next. KC2, WYQ, I think it is. Is it Whiskey Yankee Quebec? Go right ahead, Mike. Correct me, and go ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait 1 or 2 seconds beyond the beep, Michael.
No, KCQWYQ. Okay, what is the, okay, what is the PST frequency to 80 meters?
Okay, what people call the 80-meter handband starts at 3.5 megacycles and goes to 4.0 megacycles. They call that the 80-meter band, or the upper end of it they call the 75-meter band. And between 3.5 and something like 3.8, mostly Morse code takes place. And single sideband is roughly 3.8 to 4.0. Now, there's a whole bunch of other little sub-bands in there.
Okay.
Now, let's a guy who really operates that band is Mel. So tell us where the extra and the advanced and the general class section of 80 meters is. Go right ahead, Mel.
Yeah, they changed around. Yeah, it used to be a 60W band, but they figured it doesn't require so much territory for CW. So now the CW portion of the band is from 3500 to 3600, and then from 3600 going up the band all the way to 4 is FSB deck over.
Okay, are there subsections that are devoted to advanced and extra class licenses, or is the whole band from 3.6 up sideband for everybody? Over to you, Mel.
Let me remember. I have the chart here somewhere. I don't remember what the breakdown is anymore. They change things, you know, they keep changing things, so you forget from one time to another. But if you'd like it, I could pull it out here. I'm sure I've got it here. It's handy in the file. Operating portions of the band for different classes of license. But, you know, it's a very interesting band. That 160, to me, is a too interesting band of the HF series of bands. Putting 160 first, 80 meters, and then 30 meters. I should say the three unusually interesting portions of the HF band that sometimes very unpredictable, Dick, over.
WS2, and I have the chart.
Go ahead, read off the chart to us, Paul.
Yeah, okay, you got, you have, from 3.5 to 3.6 is, you know, CW and also Ridian data. And then from 3.6 all the way to 4,000, like Mel said, is, you know, phone, and you have images on that as well. And of course, you know, you're allowed CW really across all the bands pretty much. But, you know, the chart is, you know, CW is legal, even so people don't do it. You could do CW up in the phone portion of the band. But according to the present day chart, extra is, you know, from 3.6 to 4 to 4 meg, we drop it. Advanced, because, you know, some people still have advanced licenses, so that's 3.7 to 4. And then you have advanced. That was advanced. And then you have general 3.8 to 4 is for general. And the easy way to remember it for the CW portion is, you know, the extra, of course, is everything. 3.5 to 3.6. And then advanced in general, they lose the front part of it. So they can go from 3.525 to 3.6, you know, for the CW portion. That's the easiest way to remember that. And that's pretty much it. Novice and technicians, 200 watts. And that's it. Back to you there, Dick.
One of the things you're going to find out, Michael, is that 98% of all the contacts you make on the 80-meter handband or the 75-meter handband, people use those two different words, is ionospheric. Ground wave doesn't go very far. Also, you get something called D-layer absorption. At high noon, on the 80-meter band, you'll be able to talk to a guy one town away from you, you know, a few miles. But beyond that, you're not going to hear very much unless you've got extremely serious equipment. That's the usual way the band behaves. And at nighttime, when the ionosphere is there and the D-layer disappears, some nice DX takes place. By going to ARRL, to their website, I'm sure you can download the chart. There's many places where you can get the chart showing the exact frequency regions where each of the extra class and advanced class and general class licenses are allowed to operate. And when it comes to Morse code, you're allowed to operate Morse code everywhere, but by gentleman's agreement, except for periods of duress when you're trying to get a contact through under difficult conditions, people usually don't use very much Morse code in the single sideband portion of these bands. But that's strictly a gentleman's agreement. That's got nothing to do with legality. I wonder if that answers some of your questions, Michael. KC2WYQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, Paul, what I really wanted to know, I have a receiver, and I want to set it on the PSK mode, 80 meters. What would that frequency be?
Oh, PSK mode. Mel, is there a specific set of frequencies where the PSK people gather? I bet you there is. K2KEY? And after Mel, if anyone else knows, we'll go to you next. Mel first, go ahead.
Yes, Roger. As you say, gentleman's agreement type of situation. So the so-called RIDI and data and that kind of stuff is usually, well, again, it could operate legally from around 3.525 or so, but I find that all of them seem to hang around above 3.85, somewhere in that, from 8.0 to up to about 3.6. So say 3.580 to about 3.600, you'll most likely will find the data, most of the data, and well, that's where they also transmit the RIDI bulletins and all go through. So the RIDI bulletin, for instance, the ARL RIDI bulletin, and also after that, that 45 baud, and then they go to the digital bulletin number of days a week, that go over.
Go ahead, Wesley.
I don't know if that helps, but I've got the IARU region 1, and I have all of the information over 3.5. Back to you.
Dick, PSK 31 on 80 meters. It's 3580.150.
Okay. 3580.150. How about that? 3580.150. Wouldn't it be, let's see now, 3.5? Sure enough. So 150 hertz above 3580 kilohertz, if I understand you correctly. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, well, the distance between channels on PSK31 is about 100 hertz, so it's actually 3580, 150 minus, you know, there's about kilohertz to 2 kilohertz worth of operating space the way people operate. I run PSK31, very rarely run around 80 meters, but I usually run around 14070 in that neighborhood, but you'll find it spread about 150, which is pretty much the center of the band, and you can go maybe 10 kilohertz up and 10 kilohertz down, and you'll find stuff.
14070 is the best WS one.
Okay, 14070 if you're on the so-called 20-meter band. But on the 80-meter band, it looks like it's 3580.150 plus or minus 10 kilohertz.
I've got the information.
And it sounds like it's around 2 kilohertz per channel, so to speak. Go ahead, Wesley.
100 hertz per channel.
Okay, go ahead, Wesley.
Get a band plan for the FCC rules. The agreement section 97303 stands 80 meters, 3 0.590 RTTY data DX 3570 to 3600 RTTY data 3790 to 3800 DX window 3845 SSTV and 3885 AM calling frequency.
Okay, with all that information, Michael, I think it'll help you know where to start tuning. I am curious, Michael, do you own some PSK31 equipment or a computer program that does that? And sounds like you're going to start doing some listening. As soon as you start hearing something, come back next week and tell us what you heard. KC2WYQ, K2RIW in the TechNet. We got a mic. My name is Dick.
Well, I try. I have owed Radio Shack DX 440, which I have hooked into a laptop computer, and I usually listen on and I usually have hooked into PSK on 20 and 40.
Okay, sounds like you're going to have some fun with that. Let us know what you start hearing and what it required to make it work. All of these things have a learning curve. Alan was the next person who signed in, KC2. I can't read my own writing, Alan, but you know who you are. KC2 RFN, I think it is. You got it, Alan. K2RIW, the TechNet.
Right, KC2 RFN, you got it. Hello, all. Last week, you and Mel had said something interesting that I wanted to try. You had mentioned, we were talking about dipoles, and you'd mentioned that mounting a dipole vertically would perform very well, and maybe even would perform comparably to a quality vertical antenna like the Gap Titan. Well, I happen to own a Gap Titan, which is ground-mounted and functional, and so I decided to try out what you two were talking about, and I launched a line up into a tree branch, which is almost exactly 50 feet high. I had a G5 RV Junior kit, which is basically a center-fed 50-foot-long dipole, and I shot that up, pulled that up into the tree, and held it vertically by just tying down a stake into the ground and pulling it down, and then the counter traction of the rope over the branch. And then I tried it today, and I got to tell you, on receive, they were about the same. Could not really tell much of a difference. But when I was transmitting, my first transmission was to a Oscar Popper 2 Alpha in Belgium, and he was nice enough to play Switch the Antenna game with me. And I found that when I was talking with him on the vertical dipole, he was reading me at about an S5, S6. When I switched to the $350 ground-mounted Gap Titan, it dropped down to about a 2. So there's no question in my mind that the vertical dipole does definitely perform, and it's a tenth the price of a quality vertical.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Alan's last words were, if you've got a branch that's high enough, you can do it all for $30, as opposed to the $350 antenna. So S5 to S6 on the simple antenna, the vertical dipole, and S2 to Belgium on the expensive antenna. And it sort of stands to reason. Now, it's not going to be that way all the time, Alan. I think it's going to be that way the majority of the time. Depending on the state of the ionosphere and who you're talking to and how you want the bounces to occur, in theory, there is an ideal altitude of the antenna. Infinity is the best antenna, but shy of infinity in altitude, there's a number of eigenvalues of altitude that will work best. And in general, a vertical dipole has a higher phase center of radiation than almost anything you mount on the ground. So a significant percentage of the time, like almost the majority, I think you're going to find better performance out of the vertical dipole. And in your case, it was a G5 RV Junior. and I presume you're feeding it in the center. You haven't yet even experimented with methods of feeding it from the bottom, which takes a slightly different impedance matching network, or something like a J-pole. And you can even extend that to 5/8 wave type antennas. So there's a whole series of experiments of vertical dipoles that have almost never been done because they don't appear in any of the instruction manuals. Occasionally when you read, let me drop, you read a field manual for adverse conditions for the Marines or the Navy or whatever, they'll tell you about vertical antennas. But when it comes to the usual amateur literature, a dipole is always shown as an object that is straight out, flat, parallel to the ground. And very few of us do that. We've got a great big sag in the middle because of the weight of the coax, or we support it in the center, and it's really an inverted V. Very few of us, or we use it as a sloper because we support one end on the high structure, whether it be a tree or a tower or the chimney of the house, and the other end is closer to the ground. Very few of us have got a pure horizontal dipole. And there's nothing magic about that. But vertical has got a lot to go for it. Now, the experiment that Mel has done will show you that at times, depending on who you're talking to, vertical polarization will be better than horizontal. A slant 45 to the right will be better than slant 45 to the left. And the difference will be on transmit versus receive, because the way the ionosphere twists the signal in polarization by what's called Faraday rotation, the mixture of the ionosphere as a plasma material combined with the Earth's magnetic field, that combination will twist the polarization. So, and it doesn't obey reciprocity, the twist, the Faraday rotation. So the signal twisting clockwise when it goes over to London or Belgium, and twisting counterclockwise somewhat at a slightly different rate when it comes from Belgium back to Long Island, means that you may find one polarization works better on transmit and the other polarization works better on receive. So polarization agility, because antennas are in general, let me drop, particularly if you're a good smart guy homebrewing antennas, they're not very expensive. And most people do not see wire. You can string all kinds of wires around the property until you really go crazy with it and paint them with a day glow red paint. Nobody's going to complain. They're never going to see them. So putting up some horizontals and some verticals and some that favor the north-south path and some that favor the east-west path and a great big switching network in the shack, or just by switching the cables. And yes, it's a little bit inconvenient to find out that antenna A works better on transmit when you're talking to Belgium, and antenna B works better on receive when you're talking to Belgium. And to unplug the coax cable that fast, with a BNC connector you can do it, or a C connector you can do it. Unplugging a UHF and type N real fast between transmit and receive. If you don't yet have the wherewithal to buy a relay or a switch, a manual switch, these are all some of the details. So antennas are a great thing to experiment with. Sounds like you're having fun. What's your next antenna going to be, Alan? KC2RFN. And by the way, I think I gave you the wrong date. It's not November 10th. I think it's November 15th. I'm going to mail you an email address on that awards dinner over there in New Jersey. KC2RFN, the guy who created the award for me, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No problem. I'll find out the proper date and be happy to be there. And though I didn't create the award, I nominated you for it, and you certainly deserved it. My next project is I'm going to drop another line down off that same branch. By the way, I bought a tremendous slingshot. If anybody really wants to throw wires up into trees, I bought it from Cheryl Tree. Apparently they make products for shooting lines into trees. And basically it's a large slingshot on an 8-foot pole. I bought it because it was safe and easy to use. And in my first shot, I got that... the line up in the tree and then pulled up the proper rope. But my next antenna is just going to be an end-fed antenna going into the antenna tuner right next to the GR5V Junior. And I want to see if there's any difference between those two. And I've already laid out my property for a grid. I'll have probably about four or five more antennas up before winter comes, obviously, so I can play with it during the winter. And then I'll just build a switching system that will allow me to just pick the optimal antenna for transmit and receive, and play with it like that, just for fun. And I'm also going to put together a terminated folded dipole antenna, which is something I saw in QST magazine. I figure I'll throw that up before winter as well, and then happy to report it back here on TechBest. Over to you, Dick.
You got some great projects there, Alan. This 8-foot-long pole with a slingshot on it. Give us a few more words on that. Why is there an 8-foot-long pole on a slingshot as opposed to being mounted on your wrist, if you know what I mean? How many dollars? Tell us the brand name one more time. And is it intended for slinging things like antennas or just anything else that you want to put over a tree, like a high-limb trimming saw? So give us a little more description there. It's a fascinating-sounding device. Where did you find that one, Alan? KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I basically went on to Google, and I put in some keywords like ham radio, antenna, slingshot, and up came several of those wrist rockets like you were talking about. But to me, I had read some reviews in some chat forums, and apparently those wrist rockets surprise the user sometimes in that the slingshot material will bounce back violently at the user. I really don't want to take any chances with safety, so it seemed to me that it would be better to have the slingshot a little further away from me. And then I came across this company called Cheryl Tree. I don't have the spelling for it, but they had a product that was used for putting ropes up into trees, not just a little fishing line and then pull up a rope. And I said, that's interesting. And I read the reviews on it. It has an 8-foot collapsible fiberglass pole, and then it has what looks like standard surgical tubing, but they have a very nice slingshot Y made for it with a nice sling on the bottom. They give you two what look like bean bags, but they're filled with metal shot, and there's a little ring around it, and you put your they give you a little reel that clicks onto the pole. Let me drop for a moment. And then you pull down on the sling, I would say about maybe a foot and a half, maybe a little more. And it depends how much power you want and how far you want to go. And you aim the thing almost vertically. And as soon as you let go, the reel spins out just like you're casting out a fishing rod. And the thing just flies right exactly where you want it. And that's all there is to it. It's a little pricey. It's $350. I decided it was a good investment because of, one, the safety factor, which is number one for me, and number two, I intend to use it an awful lot over the coming years, so I figured it was worth having something like that.
Very nice description. Boy, that sounds like a nice piece of hardware. Like you said, a little bit pricey. Only people with slightly deeper pockets are going to go for that. Many an amateur is going to look at $350 and say, gee, I could buy a good mobile rig for that, but for guys who are going to mount a whole lot of antennas in the trees and go on field trips and field day operations, sounds like a darn good investment. Never heard about that one. I'm going to look that one up. Thank you, Alan. The next person on our list was Paul of US2N. Not sure if you've got a question and or a space report. We'll take either one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Vic. Yeah, just a space report. Just two items for tonight. This one topic about this planet that was discovered around a star called Galileo 581, about 20 light years away. It's supposed to be roughly an Earth-sized planet. It's in the Goldilocks zone, not too hot, not too cold. So most of the people in the scientific world think that it probably has water, and it probably has, it's definitely not too hot, not too cold, so you worry about it, whether or not they come up with these discoveries and everything's going to be all frozen or not. But they're looking for liquid water. And now this thing is about three times the size of Earth. And but it faces its star, it faces its sun the whole time as it goes around. Let me drop it. side is very hot and one side is very, very cold. The good news for the people looking for liquid water is at the terminator where the hot and the cold meet, you know, that whole line around that whole planet is would be perfect to be water. So, and your temperatures would be normal at those temperatures. One side you're going to be a couple hundred degrees, the other side you're going to be a couple hundred degrees minus. But at the terminator area, you might be, you know, 50, 60 degrees or whatever. So that made quite a few different news. I saw it on CNN, Fox News. Of course, read about it on the computer, on the internet. We dropped it. They've been looking at this for a while out in Keck, Hawaii. That's a telescope they've been using. They have found other planets around this particular star years ago. I think there's about a half dozen planets that they know are going around. Some are very close, and some are very far away, and this one happens to be in the right location. So it gives people hope. Not that it would be easy to get there. They're 20 light years away. So even if you sent the signal there and there was people there to send it back, it would be round trip 40 year communication. So sending a starship, I think that's a couple of hundred years away to get something up near the speed of light. Even if you did, it would take you 20 years to get there. So, there you go, Dick. That's the story about that particular planet. I wonder if you read about that.
No, I haven't, but now I'm going to go look for it. If it is a planet that is in synchronous lock, in other words, the period of rotation and the period of... in other words, it always faces the same side of the planet toward its sun. Although that can give you a area where liquid water is possible around the planet, the so-called terminator, I'm a little bit skeptical as to whether or not it is as easy to get life to form there. Because our planet rotates once every 24 hours nowadays, it used to turn faster than that when the moon was in closer, because you get continuous tides and whatever, the water is washing over certain portions of the land, wetting it every day, so to speak. I think that is part of the process that does all of the mixing that helps the biological process along and allows life to form. That's a belief on my part. And so a non-rotating planet, I think, is at a slight disadvantage. Doesn't mean it's not going to have life. I think it's just going to take longer for life to form. Let me drop. Now, when it comes to space operations, I do recommend that you guys take a look at the October issue, 2010, Scientific American. Beautiful article about the current status of the production of the James Webb Infrared Telescope. The James Webb Telescope is almost 3 times bigger in mirror diameter than the Hubble Space Telescope. It's under construction right now, and is due to be launched, I think, in the year 2014 or 2012. I think it's 2014. Construction is supposed to be completed by 2012. A whole lot of testing is going to take place, which is taking place right now, and it's going to be launched in 2014. Being 3 times bigger than Hubble gives it a lot more potential sensitivity and potential resolution, and because it is going to favor the more infrared frequencies compared to optical, it will be able to look through the dust clouds in the center of galaxies and the clouds where stars are forming and planets are forming. So it's going to give us a more of a picture of what the stellar nurseries are like. So that's going to be, I mean, you know, the amount of love that people have for Hubble. There's a good possibility that the James Webb Telescope is going to develop a similar following. I'm also hearing stories, Paul, about a possible extension of the space shuttle. So I wonder if you're hearing any words about that. WS2N, our space expert, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I might be a space enthusiast, but I don't know about being an expert, Dick. We have James Webb Telescope. The love for that telescope might be a little different. You've had, what, half a dozen missions going up to Hubble to repair it. It started off bad, real bad, and then turned out to be the best scientific piece of equipment we've ever had up there. There's a certain love for the missions that have gone up there. The guys that have not only repaired it in the beginning, but upgraded it every time they went up to Hubble. Only a couple hundred miles above the Earth. Serviceable. The problem is the James Webb telescope will not be serviceable. They're going to put that a million miles out, and that's where it's going to stay. And we don't have any space shuttles that can go more than, I think, what, 500, 600 miles was the limit on the space shuttle. So this will be 1 million miles out, four times the distance of the moon. So servicing it is not possible, which we've done before with many other space telescopes. Let me drop it. You have the Chandra Space Telescope, or you've got all these different, the ACE telescope, which looks at the sun. You've got quite a few telescopes that look at the sun that are at these Lagrange points that are not serviceable. So, just have to do a real good job on it. And that's one of these mirrors with all these hexagon pieces that are going to interconnect. It's going to open up like a big, flower when it gets up there. So all those pieces have to interconnect. It's going to be some piece of machinery. I hope it works out for them. It sounds complicated there. Space shuttle extensions. I know we've got one flight in 2011, and they talk about extending it on again, off again. But right now, the latest I heard is early February, I think, is the last flight. And that's it. Let me drop it. Congress is leaving without developing a NASA budget, so they're laying off thousands of people by the end of the year. They're just not coming up with a budget. There's no goal. There's no constellation program. There's no future robotic missions that they can work on. And, the budget has not been approved. So with that, they're going to have to wait probably late fall, maybe the winter, before they come up with a budget to find out what the next plans are there. One other thing I wanted to mention on the space report was this story about Felix Baumgartner. He dropped it. WS2ND. He's testing a spacesuit out, and the company behind it is Red Bull. So there's no government money, from what I see, involved. It's a private deal. What he wants to do is go up to a height of 23 miles and jump out of a capsule attached to this gigantic balloon, this 600-foot-high balloon, at launch anyway. It's going to turn into a round balloon after it gets up high. This big helium balloon is going to go up to the 23-mile level and jump out. It's been done as high as 20 miles high. Back in 1960 by Kettinger, Joseph Kettinger. He did it, and that's going to be his record at 23 miles, and he intends on breaking the sound barrier in the suit. That's roughly 5 minutes down, free-fall, before he opens up the chute. So, if anybody wants to go to the site, it's really a good website on the preparation of this. Let me drop it. By the way, it's supposed to be this fall. This practicing, getting ready for this for a couple of years. This fall, they don't have a date yet. If you go to the website, they don't put the date and the location. I can't find the location where this is going to be. They said date and location will be announced changing the fall. So I don't know when they're going to be ready on this, but it will definitely make the news. It was a long website, so I went to I shortened it. I went to a tinyurl.com so everybody can copy this if they want. It's really good video too. Let me drop it. And they give you all the stories about the parachute, the capsule that he's in, the spaces that he's going to be testing out. It's very well done. It's called http://tinyurl, tinyurl.com/2A92QZE. So that's 2 Alpha 92 Quebec Zulu Echo. That's the tiny URL. Sure, they take back to you.
Wow. Does anybody worry about the fact that when he breaks the sound barrier and then starts hitting the Earth's atmosphere, whether or not that impact will be significant? Once again, tinyurl.com/2Alpha92QuebecZuluEcho, if I got that right. Or maybe I dropped one of the numbers. Back to you, Paul.
That's what I wrote here. I have to read my own handwriting. Tinyurl is a good website. For ham radio, I'll tell you that. You get these websites out, they're a mile long. If anybody gets it right the first time, we're lucky to shorten it. Maybe somebody wants to try it and see if it works. I tried it here. It worked out good. Well, he's up in an atmosphere that's roughly 0.1% of our atmosphere. That's where he's starting out. So that would be equivalent to, let's say, being on Mars. So there is very little atmosphere up there, and that's the reason he's going to be able to get up to the speed of roughly 700 miles an hour to break the sound barrier. Because there's no air to slow him down. It's free fall. It's kind of like the moon, you know, when an asteroid or a meteor hits the moon, there's nothing to slow it down. It's flying at 50, 60,000 miles an hour, 100,000 miles an hour. But it's Earth, you know, because of the atmosphere, terminal velocity really slows things down quick. I think parachuters are around 120, 130 miles. You reach terminal velocity when you just normally jump out of a plane. But when you're up that high, there's nothing to slow you down. So he'll gradually pick up some friction, and that will tend to slow him down there. But the idea is eventually to have some kind of escape mechanism. Remember, Columbia blew up in the upper atmosphere, 200,000 feet up. This guy's 120,000 feet up, I think. Let me drop it.
And 2MB.
Do you want to pick up Barry, Dick?
Barry, recognize. Finish your thought there, Paul. Go ahead.
I just wanted to ask Paul one question. What is the possibility this fellow will start to warm up when he starts entering the lower atmosphere?
It'll be a gradual deal. He's like the super-duper parachutist. He's like a base jumper, you know, one of these guys that jump off antenna towers and bridges. He's going to fly as horizontally as possible, not straight down. And, you know, he knows how to do that. So that'll stop him from heating up. He's in a spacesuit. He is pressurized, 3.5 PSI, which is the equivalent of being 35,000 feet up. And so I know what Mount Everest is, 28,000. Everybody thinks, oh, my God, that's no good. You need oxygen and everything. You'd pass out if you were suddenly put at a 35,000-foot height. But what it is he's breathing pure oxygen in this spacesuit. In a closed cabin. The cabin is pressurized as he goes up. So, you know, even if there was an accident up there and he lost pressure in his suit, he could survive in the cabin. They said it's not likely. So he'll jump out. He'll be breathing pure oxygen at 3.5 PSI. That's the reason, you know, he won't pass out. Although it's very low pressure, he'll be breathing pure oxygen, similar to the astronauts when they take off, especially the early astronauts like Mercury and Gemini, when you drop it.
Paul, tell us, what do you believe is the pressure at which a extravehicular activity in a normal spacesuit outside of a shuttle takes place? Back to you, Paul.
Hey, C2MDP.
Steve, recognize Paul first.
Yeah, that's 5 PSI, pure oxygen. And that's how they do it. Any more pressure than that, I mean, as it is, their movements inside the pressurized suit, very hard to move your joints around. You know, if you had higher pressure, if you ran it up to 14.7 atmospheric, you'd never be able to bend your arm. The good thing there is you could run, you know, your normal oxygen, nitrogen levels like you have on Earth. You won't be able to move, so the compromise is to run lower pressure and pure oxygen. Dick?
Fascinating. Still, though, I don't think that even if he is successful with this particular operation from 23 miles up, that's a straight down, starting off at zero velocity fall. In the case of the Columbia, those guys were coming into the atmosphere at close to 17,000 miles an hour of horizontal velocity, as well as the gravity starting to pull you into a vertical descent. So it's a much more difficult environment. I don't think a properly equipped astronaut that was able to bail out of the Columbia would have been able to survive without a lot more extra hardware, is my belief. Steve, KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone else on the net. Dick, I am not too sure of the particulars, but I'm almost 100% sure this was done before. It might have been that guy from the 60s. From what I remember, I will definitely look this up. From what I remember, he was testing some kind of suit. I wasn't sure if it was a space suit or if it was a flight suit, but he basically did the same thing, bailed out of a balloon. And from what I understand, that guy did most definitely break the sound barrier. Back to you, Dick.
Interesting. And according to Paul, that particular jump in the 60s was 20 miles up. This one's going to be 23 miles. And where's the threshold where you can't go beyond? Obviously, if you just dropped in from the moon, so to speak, you would pick up a ridiculously high velocity. And when you first hit the atmosphere, I think it would be quite dangerous, quite an experiment. Thank you for that information, Paul, and for that tiny URL website. I'm going to check that one out. The next person on our list was...
Take one more thing. WS going.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I missed the hand's name that just came on. But yeah, he's right. They say that Joe Kimmings did break the sound barrier back in 1960. But it wasn't documented. They didn't have... I'm trying to remember when I read this, but they didn't have the equipment to tell if he did or not. They theorized that he did, but it wasn't formalized. So this guy will, because of all today's technology and equipment and tracking and everything, this guy will definitely prove that he did do it. Where I think Kissinger, they say, well, he did it, but you know, it's not really quite, you know, it's a gray area. We don't have concrete proof. But yeah, he was testing out parachutes and things like that. In fact, his glove was leaking. His hand blew up like twice the size on his way down. So, you know, technology has changed. I can't wait until this comes out on the news. This will be great.
Sounds like a fascinating project. High risk too. Brave guys. That Colonel Stack, who put himself on these rocket sleds, and decelerated himself at ridiculously high rates, you know, numbers like 15 and 18 G's in the reverse, in the forward direction, just to find out what a human body can take. And he's doing the experiment on himself. Dedicated guy. Next person on the list was Paul, N2DQI. We've been skipping over Mel's mailbag. Let me first check with Paul and see if he's able to wait a little bit longer. N2 Delta Quebec India, if you're there, Paul. K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay, maybe Paul's not there. Mel, well, what kind of mail you been getting this week? And did we create any controversy on the answers we gave last week? K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, it's a little late for a mailbag for most of the young people that I usually answer questions here with that, you know, the subjects that they bring up. I'm afraid maybe just about in bed, Dick. I tried to do it a little earlier. However, yeah, that was always controversy. Let me just say a few words about, let's back up a little bit, get back to basically ham radio and some. I know we're going to get some questions about vertical antennas, and maybe I'll defend the antenna, that gap antenna, a little bit by saying if you have a situation where you don't have a tree with branches that you can hang antennas or whatever, and you need something with a, as they say, a small footprint, in certain instances, these verticals, know they are a little costly, but they do supplant the situation of nothing. You understand? There is the basic idea. You need something that small footprint that will cover a good number of the amateur radio band. They do work for that point to be, you know, taken into consideration. Dick, over.
Okay. I see where you're going with that, and you're absolutely right. No antenna is perfect for everybody. We all have our limitations and our favorites and so on. But homebrewing antennas are where we amateurs can really shine. When it comes to the transmitter receiver for 80 through 10 meters, almost nobody will build that today. When Mel and I cut our teeth, an awful lot of guys would homebrew their receiver and homebrew their transmitter on 80 through 10 meters. Not anymore. They're much too complicated. But the antennas we can homebrew. And I think the main thing we're trying to emphasize is there's a lot of inexpensive antennas that probably can be squeezed onto your property a high percentage of the time. And we amateurs, once we get really rolling with the hobby, there's almost never enough antennas. One that favors east-west, one that favors north-south, one that favors vertical polarization, one that favors horizontal polarization, and so on. One that's got more gain on a particular band, one that can be aimed with a rotator, one that can be aimed electronically. There's all kinds of antennas. You scan the antenna engineering handbook, and you'll see evidence that there are 5,000 kinds of antennas. And a certain percentage of those 5,000 antennas we amateurs can use. And so don't fall into the trap of doing exactly what everyone else is doing. There's a lot of choices there with antennas. So try to choose one of the questions, Mel, that you think the older guys that maybe can stay up a little bit later. Let's go through at least one of them tonight. K2KEY and K2RIW. I'll try to get in there earlier next week.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, the younger ones, more or less, were asking about after the so-called discussion about antennas last week. And remember, we did discuss Balun, 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 however you want to pronounce Balun, I guess is the correct balance to unbalance. And now comes the situation with tunas, because there are a number of tunas that are off-it, because you did mention that, you know, at a certain point you do need a tuner in the system. All right, well, I'm trying to find something else here. Let's see. Geez. Trying to find something that, you know, that the I could say maybe some older people would be interested in. And, oh, yeah. Well, I've been getting questions lately about, you know, you start talking about alternate power, Dick, about certain questions about wind generation, over.
Yeah, when it comes to renewable energy resources, and there's about five or six of them, tide and wind and solar voltaic